Hello and welcome to the On the Whistle podcast. I am your host today, Alistair Howarth. We have a very, very special guest with us today. And of course, I'm talking about Firdaus Munda, our women's football expert from South Africa. Firdaus, you've had your time covering the cricket. You're back with us. You're back to talk about football. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Alistair. Yeah, really well. It's been a great summer. In fact, it's still late summer here in South Africa. Beautiful Cape Town weather. I've been keeping my eye on the football, particularly the Olympic qualifiers. Really thrilled to see Banyana Banyana getting through to that final round. They're going to play Nigeria, so I think it's going to be a really, really tough task for them. But it's all about the Olympics. I'm hearing a lot of conversation about that, and I've got sort of two feelings about it. You know, it's only two teams from Africa that go there, and yet we put so much focus on it. And at the same time, there's so much other football on the continent that maybe we don't really talk about because of the focus on the Olympics. So the Women's League has started here in South Africa as well. There have been some interesting performances. The games are being streamed. Some of them are on television, which is really good to see. And I think we're going to have a good couple of months of football. I think the last time we spoke, SAFA was still in the running for the Women's World Cup 2027, but unfortunately they pulled out. So no World Cup on the continent, but lots to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you know, it feels like a shame that one of Nigeria and South Africa won't be going to the Olympics, because both of them have shown how brilliant they are, particularly at the World Cup. But enough of South Africa, enough of Nigeria. Today, we are talking about one country, and that is Ghana and the Black Queens. And that is because we are joined by head coach Nora Hopdo. Nora, you have come into this team, you've come into this job as the coach, I think in your first nine games. I'm sure you'll correct me wrong, but it's 9 wins. 0 goals conceded, 31 goals scored. You know, how are you doing today? And where are you calling us from?
Good morning, first of all, to everybody. And two questions. So first, I'm currently in Europe scouting between the camps, a lot of players visiting. I was Saturday in Sassuolo, scouting players of us or players who are maybe in the future eligible to play for Ghana. And of course, yeah, we had a long story already written in our Mission Volta this year. I took over the A national team in January 23, before I was already on the World Cup with under 20. We announced in our Mission Volta the vision that we want to come back to the top four in Africa, chasing for the lead, maybe winning a trophy. So these were like our two vision points. And then we started with a lot of scouting in domestic. We made camps, and from there we built the first friendlies. We started then with the Olympic and WAFCON qualifications. And after 1 year now, we can say, yeah, we are back on the big tournament. First time since 2016. Unfortunately, we missed the Olympic qualification. We got scored in the 96th minutes down in Zambia. But it was a big game, and we always try to separate a bit results and performance indicators. And we should have probably the first game to take a point out there. The indicators were quite good, our performance as well, so it gives us the sign that we are on the right way in the Mission Volta. In the starter 11 have been 5 players from the last under 20 World Cup, so you need to understand that we are still a young squad, but we develop well, and I'm quite satisfied what we achieved until now.
Yeah, it's been an amazing achievement. I mean, it feels right for Ghana to be back amongst the big names of African football, because, you know, they traditionally with Nigeria are kind of the big heavyweights. And then, yeah, for the last kind of 4 or 5 years, they've kind of been in the wilderness. But we'll get into that. But we want to kind of start with you and hear a bit more about your story, because even before you became the coach of Ghana, you have a remarkable story kind of playing in Switzerland, playing for the national team and coaching. Tell us a bit more about, you know, yourself as a player and how you got into coaching.
Yeah, indeed. I play myself very long, but I always try to be a coach who is not always telling about me when I was a player, you know. So that's, yeah, I played for our national team in Switzerland. And of course, it was also a different time, you know, 20 years ago, there were a lot of more fights for structures. Switzerland is a small country. So for us, it was important to reach the big tournaments. We have a very good education system in football, so I'm happy that I got teach probably as player already very good. And then since 2015, Switzerland is now on all the big tournaments, always present. Yeah, that's where I come from, and maybe this is also influencing you then very much when you get later a coach, you know, in your yeah, mindset and how do you wanna structure the way you're gonna work, you know? So that's yeah, key. My roots in Switzerland, of course.
Nora, can I ask you about being the first female coach in the Bundesliga and what that might have been like for you? You know, from an environment perspective, but also from a level of pride. I mean, there must be a lot to be said for being there amongst that sort of fraternity and feeling like, hey, I've made it. I'm here.
Yeah, I think for me it was important to build my coaching career step by step, and it started earlier in Switzerland when I stopped playing. I had foot surgeries, and then I got the offer from my club to teach the boys under 15 and get a professional job. So I did my A license by teaching in Switzerland 3 years under 15, 16 boys on national level. That was a big chance, and I had luck that somebody saw and gave me this opportunity. After that, I was 5 years training the under 19 national team from Switzerland and building a talent development program, which is still existing. And when COVID came, there were no games on youth level. So I decided to step abroad into the Bundesliga. Indeed, it's the first time a Swiss coach went in on female side into the Bundesliga. And I learned a lot there. Every step I made teach me new things, you know. When you are with the boys, you learn to fill the backpack with tools, you know, which you need to be a good coach on the pitch. In the under 19 national team, I learned a lot management of a bigger staff. When you go to European Championship, you have 15 staff members, so you need to teach another team. And in the Bundesliga, it was business. You know, we were a club which was a bit on the lower side of the league, so we had not so much budget. And then it was how can we frame the environment in terms of building a strange room or all those things. How can I get an assistant coach which is professional with me working? How do we find the budget? I was scouting there, interesting wise, for example, Barbara Banda. She was already in China, and China was in the COVID season, they were on hold the league. So we put an offer to her club. And unfortunately, her salary was too high to get her on loan. But I created like a scouting system to look where are the gaps, where we can, with our budget, reach young players, leagues in COVID. So it was very interesting business-wise. I learned a bit how the the business in football is working.
Yeah, and can I just ask you about that difference between, I mean, you mentioned that richness of coaching across a variety of boys' structures, age group structures, and so on, and then making the transition to coaching a women's national side. Is there a big difference in terms of your personality, in terms of the skill set? What would you say those differences are?
Yeah, in Switzerland there too, in 5 years under 19. I mean, this was youth level. That's again another story than when you work with senior ladies. And in the club level, you have more time to develop, of course, players, because you are daily on the pitch with video and so on. So you can work out a lot of potential. For me, national team side, you have not so much time to develop the players. It's more very quick getting a good structure tactic wise. You know, you normally have three sessions and then you have a game. So you need to be very clear in the frame tactic, and the player needs to understand it quick. And of course, it's then dealing with the personalities. This is in both sides important, but in national team, you get good players, so you need to work to get them in scouting-wise. But then it's, of course, the whole team frame. It needs to be a working team very quick, you know. So it needs to have value-based work and then a clear leadership frame. So those things, I think it's very important in national team. And in club side, you do a bit the same, but you have much more time and you can develop also players much more football-wise, let's say like this.
And you know, you talked about learning about how to kind of manage a team, how to manage boys and then girls, and then kind of the business side at a club level. You know, you go from, you know, coaching in the Bundesliga to becoming the Ghana Black Queens coach. You know, tell us, how did that happen? Did the FA approach you? Did you apply for what? Like, what is the story behind actually coming to? Because Ghana's a very, very different place from Switzerland and from Germany. So, you know, tell us a bit more about how that came about.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I was very open afterwards to work abroad. The connection also came over FIFA, that Ghana was looking for a technical advisor for the under 20 national team who went in on the World Cup in Costa Rica. And I got then a request, and like this, the bridge was built. I clearly said there was already a bit, of course, a question about the A team. And I was in between shortly in Israel working there. I learned a lot. So I said that I'm going to come to the under 20 World Cup and want to have a picture of the environment. You know, how is the player level? How is the management around the team and so on? How is the leadership in the FA? That's crucial if you want to get success on the A team level. And when I get an impression, I make you a report and a feedback, and then we can discuss the A national team if it's fitting for me and if I fit also for you. It needs to be a marriage in the end. And this is how we built it then in Ghana. For me, there were two things highly interesting. First of all, I saw these talents, fantastic players. And when I screened the world picture, then I saw that there are over 60 players around the world which we can make maybe playable for Ghana and bring them back. Meanwhile, there are over 110 players which I have on my scouting radar. So this high potential of players and going in an environment where I need to develop myself, you know. So for me, the interest behind it, it sounds maybe a bit ridiculous for others, but I learned the most in this whole journey over myself, because you reach borders, you know. You need to rethink your ethic normative value setting, because it's different what I was used sometimes to the culture from Switzerland, and it's not right or wrong, it's just different. And I knew when I jump in there and when I have the resilience to survive, and then I will learn quite a lot, and this was another very big motivation for me to take this job.
And I want to ask kind of you, because we've been following the women's game for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years now on this podcast. And since we've really started, we had, like I mentioned before, like Desiree Ellis, when she just first took the South Africa job. And I wanted to ask kind of how much has the growth of women's football on the continent in the last few years, did that impact your decision? Because obviously we saw then the success of the teams at the World Cup after you took charge of Ghana. You know, we saw the brilliance of Nigeria, South Africa, Morocco and Zambia. But, you know, even as in the previous WAFCON in 2022, you know, I was out there in Morocco covering it, and it was a brilliant tournament. You know, Morocco hosted a great tournament and it was so competitive. You know, we saw those kind of big four heavyweight teams really emerge for the first time. You know, before you took the job, kind of how much did you know about not just Ghanaian football, but about the context of women's football on the continent, And, you know, how much, you know, was that maybe informed by kind of seeing the more recent success of those teams?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the first deeper touch I got really when I was scouting in the Bundesliga for my team there, because I tried to find players which we can still afford, you know, to pay, but which have highly interesting KPIs. So I was I'm working very data-based to have an objective opinion, and I tried and still try to be always a bit in advance and anticipate where is the football going, so what do we need in 2 years, or what is interesting in 4 years. So I studied also like fitness data from the US and tried and also to get some data from the African country. And I think, for example, Banda's performance at the Olympics, last Olympics, you know, there were quite highly indicators, bless you, to see, okay, there is coming also a certain kind of physicality in Africa, which can be competitive on world level, compared with extremely skillful players, you know. So I knew that there is gonna coming a wave when you maybe add also a bit the missing things in terms of a good tactical frame, you know. And I also knew that I can deliver this very good in this system. Then I followed, of course, the under 20 World Cups are also indicative for the higher level, and then you see also in the last World Cup that the African teams are now ready to go in the knockout stages. Yeah, I think Nigeria, I mean, they'll go out in a penalty shooting. It's, yeah, this is then a bit part of the game, but I think there's a high potential, not even in the four countries who have been on the World Cup. Also, Ghana has a very interesting player, but you need to work very much on the environment. For example, that you fight, that you can fly in the best players, that you have the budget for. FIFA made a report where you see how many games are the African teams playing, and the scissor is so big, you know. I analyzed Zambia. They played last year, I think, 21 official games, 21. We, Ghana, played 11. And then there are teams that played 2 or 4 games, you know, and this is it. So this scissor is so big, so you need to, of course, very screen properly the country, what is possible, because when you cannot play those games and working for the place, then you cannot jump on the next level. So, but for me, yeah, I see a lot of potential, and this was my motivation, because I still believe that Ghana is ready also to go on a big tournament.
And that's so reassuring for me to hear, that even before you came, you know, you were aware of these players, and in very much kind of like you mentioned KPIs, and kind of very much in a kind of asset based way of thinking of these players have resale value, that they have talent. And we've seen that recently with players like Barbara Banda, Rachel Kundinanji, kind of becoming these record breaking transfers, you know, going to the NWSL. And, you know, I think it's something that we've beat the drum on. You know, I remember that first CAF Champions League tournament that we covered, and seeing some of the players from Ghana, you know, like Evelyn Badu, Doris Boadua, and seeing them now making that jump to Europe, or Grace Asantewa kind of now making that jump to Europe and then to Mexico. You know, for you as a coach, how kind of rewarding is that to see that these players, particularly I think the ones that you've been working with at the under 20 level, but also other, you know, players from other countries who traditionally from, you know, Europe or the North American context would have been overlooked, are now actually being picked up and are playing and are, you know, getting the contracts they deserve, the money they deserve, kind of and the spotlight that they deserve.
Yeah, it's what I believed when I saw those players. You know, I try always to see the potential and ask myself, can we work out this potential and support the players in different kind of ways? For example, that when they go abroad, that they are used to video analysis and those skills, because when you jump in into the European market, normally you need to very quick adapt to this environment, also a bit career planning, you know, which is your next good step. of course, it's for them interesting to earn money. And we need also to understand this. You know, money is, for me as Swiss, is not my biggest driver, but I understand when an African player or from Ghana is supporting a whole family, and then money is a very big driver. So you see, I also need to learn to understand the other position, that I can help them the best. And so at the moment we discuss a lot with the player, what is a good next step, which is a good next club, which is educating your father, who is the coach, what is the interest, which position do you play, how many playing minutes. So all those highly relevant indicators that they can develop really, and not just fill their pocket. Which leagues are growing? You know, it's not only the big five, of course, but there are also other leagues in Turkey, for example, which make big steps. So we try to support, of course, also or question our players in this way, because when they play in better club environments and have a lot of playing minutes there, normally they perform then faster and better also in the national team. And of course now the transfers of Kundananji Obanda is showing probably also the world how much potential there is in Africa, you know. Still sometimes, I don't know the English word, I also feel it that Ghanaian players or African players are sometimes underestimated, you know, just because of the where they are coming from. And I'm very happy to see that, I think, step by step a bit now, this, how do you call this English word, the prediction? Oh, no, it's not a prediction. It's when you put somebody in a board or in a cupboard, you know. And
oh, like prejudice?
So you have an opinion, but you
yeah,
you don't know what it's based on, you know, and yeah. I think now we are working a lot against those presetted
almost
minds.
Like a stereotype, yeah.
Stereotype. Maybe it's this word I was looking for, you know. Yeah. And those transfers, of course, are helping not only Kundananji, but also all the African players to get a bit better in the market. Yeah.
Nora, you speak about potential, and I'm just wondering what the balance is then between what Ghana can offer local players versus what an overseas deal can. I mean, is the structure, how professional is it domestically? Can they earn a decent living? But also, can they then produce a player that you'll be confident can go onto the international stage and perform? Or is that scouting list that you mentioned of 60 players, are those people who are coming from the diaspora that you think will be able to elevate the quality of your team?
Yeah, I think there are also two questions in your question. First of all, it's always understandable the demand of implementing domestic players which are still living in Ghana into the national team. When I arrived, I took, again, data to see what is our league really about. So I took all the playing licenses. And I saw that over 75 of the players have been under 20 years old. So de facto, our Premier League, it's a youth league. You know, so you need to sometimes clear look at what it is. And that means we need to feed especially our under 20 national team out of our league players, because they are young, you know. It's difficult to go and want to compete on Olympics with 16-year-old players, you know. Maybe you can implement the talent, but maybe then building a domestic squad, you know, like a B national team on the top of the under 20, that you can still educate the bit older players in the league, you know. But when you want to be competitive, you need to have a bit an older age group of players, and normally they go just abroad. So they play 3 years in Ghana, and when they reach 18, 19, then they are from the justice right to travel or sign a contract, then they are abroad, because there they can earn money. In Ghana, you get maybe feeding and those things, housing. but you cannot earn a lot of money. So it's normal, the market, that they go abroad. And then it's also, of course, then we need to collect our players also abroad. But the fact that you need to show that we are a youth league in Ghana and in often maybe in other leagues too, that doesn't mean that we need to develop, you know, those players too, and maybe working on the club environments, on the league development, and all those things. But we need to accept that our players play in Europe. We have over 110 players on our worldwide radar. Some are in college, some, and then there is another part from players which did not grow up in Ghana, but which have Ghanaian ancestors, which are eligible to play. And also there, when there is a highly interesting player in England playing for Arsenal or whatever, then you need to, of course, also hook in there and try to make them eligible. So it's a bit, you know, seeing the big pictures, the gaps, and working from, shooting from every side, I always say.
Yeah. How interested are those players that you mentioned, you know, some of those that are abroad, who have Ghanaian ancestry? I mean, do you have to lure them in by, you know, maybe, I don't know whether it's promising an international cap or money or a different lifestyle or connection to their roots, or are they quite keen, do you find?
Yeah, of course, it's first always valuing their potential, because they need to be better than somebody who is in on their position. Otherwise, it's not worth to work them in. That's a bit my job. Then it's getting contact to them. And normally I speak to them in a chat, and listen to their commitment. For me, when I was a national team player, it needs always to be an honor to play for this country. And you need to feel a certain connection. It's very difficult to just wear a shirt and... because first it's always pride, honor to play for your country, and then everything else is coming. And when this space is not here, then there is, it's not possible to bring such a player in. And then it's of course also, the interest. And I mean, when we go to big tournaments, we are highly attractive, for players, because normally when they come to national team, perform well, they can also raise their market value. So it's of course always also then a bit of self-interest. And I try to show very clear, how is our Mission Volta working? Are they really committing for this pass, you know, until this time frame? Are they willing to, there's also a lot of travel. It's not easy when you play like Asante in Juarez, you need to fly back to Accra, then you have game in Dola, then you go, you know, she's traveling sometimes 2-3 days with time changements and so on. So you need to be willing to invest this energy, and I think you get a lot of payback in terms of getting games on a high level, having exposure on tournaments. And sometimes national team gives you also something, it's difficult to explain, you know, to be in this team and reaching things, it can give you a lot of energy and breaking a bit the daily club rhythm. So our players need to be very committed also to our values, and otherwise it's not working. So it's a bit everything.
Nora, I spent the last month, well, January and February in Cote d'Ivoire and Abidjan, mainly covering the men's African Cup of Nations. So I spent a lot of time with Ghanaian journalists and some players. And whilst the men's team was struggling and got knocked out at the group stage again for the second time, all of the journalists I spoke to were saying, like, there is just so much positivity around the Black Queens. There's so much kind of goodwill towards the team. They're doing so brilliant. And so many of them kind of were saying, oh, so much as that is down to Coach Nora. She's done so much good work. And one of the things that I think all of them mentioned when I asked them, why, you know, what is it about Nora that's made the difference? How is she, you know, succeeding where a lot of others are struggling? Is they're saying, you know, she's a foreign coach who's come from Europe, but she actually has lived in Ghana. She spent a lot of time in the country, you know, watching local football, investing in the football. And, you know, I think there's a lot of resentment you know, certainly in the men's game, and I think the women's game as well, from African nations, where they see, you know, foreign Europe, you mainly European coaches coming in, they come in for the, you know, maybe just for the international break, and then they leave and they go back and live wherever. And even maybe sometimes they ask the team to have their international breaks outside the country. Maybe they have their training in Europe and stuff. But so all of them have said, you know, that what makes a difference, and you even alluded to it earlier, was your willingness to learn from the players as much as they learn from you, and learning about what it is to be Ghanaian. You know, what I want to ask you, what made you have that decision to really kind of invest in not just the national team, but the country itself, and be kind of, what are some of those lessons that you have learned, and both about yourself, but also about Ghana?
Yeah, well, thank you. It's beautiful to hear that there are positive voices supporting, of course, a bit our way. It's my approach is to have a growth mindset. I cleared very basically my values, you know, how do I want to act? How do I want to be? What is important for me as human being? And yeah, a growth mindset that I am continuously learning of my stages is for me one of the highest values I have. And then also giving empowerment to people around. And in Ghana, it's you need to dive in the culture to understand, first of all, the environment. It's very difficult to take conclusions or decisions when you don't get first informations in. So in the beginning, I was a lot in the performance center, and we had our first camps, selection camps in Pram, you know, sometimes no electricity, sometimes no fluent water, you know, one pitch, AstroTurf, which was really ready to play, but like 3-4 teams who wanted to train on it. So yeah, it's you need to see the reality to know on what you can build, you know, and there is a lot of investment in Ghana, and also the center is growing, but I need to be there, and sometimes I reached my borders also, you know, it was not that it was just easy, and but from there I understood, yeah, very clear. I'm a very feedback based person, so after every camp I made our president and deputy a clear feedback what it needs to go next, and maybe you focus on 5 points and then you reach 3, but then your journey is going forward, you know. So this was for me highly important to show them all the time in a realistic way, okay, what is next? Do we need to go in a hotel? Do we need to, material in staff environment? What do we need to change for the next camp? So this was highly interesting for me. Then also learning the culture, the food, the value setting. I mean, creating a picture like the Mission Volta. Yeah, Volta is the river. It's meandering, a bit like our way. Volta means to turn. It's a Portuguese word. So we wanted to turn to success. So also using and understanding where are the queens coming from, and where do we want to go, with what picture can we work. And then also with the staff, clearing very clear the ethic normative value setting. They need to understand how I want to work. And a lot of them have been used to be the POD culture, like push the others down. It's often in Africa that you swim on the top by pushing others down. This is not how I understand to work with people. I want to empower, and they need to understand this first, you know, and I need to understand where they are coming from, that we can implement this kind of culture in our staff. But this needs all time, and it's not that you can come and just say it's like this. So sometimes you need to extend a bit your value setting, but there maybe are things I cannot accept, and this you need to you need to clear it with commitments. With we always write the things down together. Everything is in a written commitment. And it's, you need to work those things through, and it's very difficult when you just dive in and tell everybody how you think it should be, and then they look at you and say, yeah, but what do you know about us? And there are a lot of value things which you can build on, you know, and I don't know everything, so I found a lot of beautiful things, and I don't know, singing before the game, it's so much releasing, you know. I can hardly clap in the rhythm, so but then I need to let it go and try to, you know, so many beautiful moments I had where I realized, wow, this is something I don't know, and it's beautiful, so let's keep it or build on this. So this openness, I think it's very crucial. I often then, when I reflect, it's maybe I want to lead with more transformal leadership, and often in Ghana, like, it was more a transactional leadership, and it, sometimes then you realize, you know, it gives you a lot of questions back. You cannot just do it like the way, you previewed. But I learned a lot again on myself. How do I want to lead, and what is possible, and sometimes also to accept what is not possible. Having a big reduction on things, priority-based working. So in Switzerland, we are details, you know, about 100 millions of details. And I imagine it's a beautiful story when I was in Pram Pram and I had a bad day. Sometimes you have bad days, you know, it's... And the leader, the manager of Pram Pram, Winifred, called me to her office and told me, Nora, sit down. And she said, Nora, how many car signs did you see when you drove to Pram Pram? It's about 2 hours away from Accra. And I said, what do you ask me about car signs? You know, I'm pissed because we cannot train on the time we want. And she said, no. How many car signs? They said, I think none, you know. And then maybe in Accra, a red signal, you know, at the street. And then she said, look, it's a bit, you want today, you come in and you want to put 10 street signs, you know, and it's cognitive too much. People cannot follow you. It's you are overloading. So maybe I advise you, maybe you put one street sign today and look how it's, and then maybe next week you and those little moments, you know. Then I went home and needed to reflect a bit on it and said, yeah, it's much more reduction, you know, much more priorities on things. So you see, I learned the most, like I told you in the beginning. So yeah.
Nora, it sounds like you've really embraced Ghanaian culture and also West African culture. And there's a big debate we have in the west of the continent, which I'm hoping you will give us a little hint into. And the question is, who makes the best jollof rice? So I'm assuming you've tasted the Ghanaian version. Have you tasted any others? And which one's the best?
Yeah, of course. I try a lot of things, and I always need to be a bit careful. Some things are very spicy, you know, for me. So then I sweat a lot, and the jollof. I like the jollof when it's not too spicy, for example. But one of my favorite is okra stew. Actually, okra stew I like a lot, and then of course also all the fruits and everything. But I'm always open to try new things. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. And I imagine that the Ghanaian palate is just slightly different from the Swiss palate in terms of the type of food you eat.
Yeah, you know, Switzerland, we have a lot of cows, and so we produce a lot of cheese and those things. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's funny. In the beginning, we always brought some chocolate down, and In Ghana, you have one of the best cacao productions.
Yeah.
And then I always told our president, I'm closing the circle because probably the cacao was exported to Switzerland. We add the milk, and now I bring back the chocolate, you know.
And that's actually a really nice metaphor, right, for like what you're doing. Like the raw product is all in Africa, and then it has to sometimes go out and get refined. What a beautiful metaphor for kind of your journey is the cacao and the chocolate. You should write a book, and that should be your title.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Nora, I kind of want to bring it back because you've mentioned this kind of Mission Volta, and that kind of was the basis of why you came to Ghana. Kind of your remit is predominantly to get Ghana back into the Women's Africa Cup of Nations. You know, they hadn't been they, you know, obviously we didn't have it in 2020. They didn't qualify for 2022, losing out to Nigeria. And, you know, in 2018, they were there, but at home, but they didn't even get out of the group stage. And so it was kind of your job to get them back onto the map. And, you know, when you, you know, mentioned it in your introduction, when you took over, it was plain sailing. You know, you won every single game. You didn't concede any goals. And then you had that matchup against Namibia. And even though you lost the second leg in Namibia, you qualified for that WAF run. And there's this great video of you kind of just breaking down into tears and, you know, showing just the amazing emotion of that. What was that, you know, moment like for you reflecting on your own journey and your journey with Ghana, the moment that you actually kind of achieved that first objective, you qualified for the Women's Africa Cup of Nations?
Yeah, well, I'm also human, you know, and I'm glad I have a good staff who is supporting me all the time, so I never feel alone. It's all teamwork we do. And of course, this moment was releasing. Sometimes, maybe as spectator, you think you always enjoy games, but it's not that you enjoy all the time games. Sometimes it's big pressure also behind, and you know, you need to deliver now or never, otherwise. And of course, there it was a big release. I mean, we scored Namibia home 3-1 with our own goal. So the first goal we conceded was our own goal. It's also, and then we got a set piece in there. And then we knew there are different rules, you know, in WAFCON and the Olympics. With the away goal in WAFCON, you can also fall out, you know, when it's sometimes matches can turn quickly. So in the end, it was a release, but deserved probably. And there are a lot of travels. There are a lot of physical intensity behind. Of course, there are a lot of things you work behind the scenes, which nobody knows ever. So you have, as a leader, you are not only here for the players. You need to work for your staff, for their environment. In the end, you are a lot in between also in discussions with the president, deputy, the technical director, so the leaders, and of course also higher interests like sport ministry and so on. So when you are in between all those demands, it's not easy all the time. And when you can, in the end, when it's ending the way you previewed, or then it's of course also a release, and maybe also how is the English word for it, that you know, okay, your anticipations have been probably right, the potential you saw, you can really achieve it, but you need to deliver it in the end with the result and the qualification, you know. Only performance valuing people also don't understand, you know. So in the end, it needs to be the qualification. Yeah. So it was a big release.
And Laura, now you've got them there, you've qualified for the Women's AFCON, but from what we're hearing, I mean, the tournament dates are not set. The Olympics, we know, takes place at the end of July. There's a chance the tournament will take place later, I suppose, perhaps even next year. How do you feel about that? I mean, you're obviously anticipating playing, I guess, in June, July. Now, where do you stand?
Yeah, it's a big questionnaire. It's quite difficult when you don't know where to head to, you know. So because the planning, it's crucial, and it makes a big change for us when it's the WAFCON is going to be happening next year. I myself neither don't know when. You need to understand that most African countries pay their camps over the ministry. And normally the ministry jumps in terms of qualification games. So when you're out of a qualification and need to run now 1 year only friendlies, then normally the most part of the money is spoiled back to the FA, and they need to pay for a camp. And most African FAs just don't have a very high budget, you know, and there are also other things which we need to accept, that there is now futsal, you know, growing, and they also need budget for that. So, of course, the men's national team are the drivers. They also bring in at the moment the most part of the money through their qualifications. Maybe it's going to change everything when FIFA is raising or equalizing the prize money. That would be an absolutely game changer. But at the moment, then we need to work with a reduced budget, and it will be very difficult to fill every FIFA window with the camp. And then again, then we reduce the amount of games. And my opinion is at least an A national team needs to have at least 10 games per year. That's the minimum, you know, that you can develop as team, that the players have this exposure on high intensity level and so on. But in the end, we always come back to resources. And it's at the moment for us, it's not helping that this tournament is postponed another year. Probably then already the next WAFCON qualification needs to start somehow because World Cup is, you know, so it's, so my I would have loved that it's going to happen this June, like previewed. Then it's Olympics, then it's under 20 World Cup in September, which you can also not interfere with the WAFCON. It's not good for us. And it also gives us challenges which are very difficult to solve, to be honest.
What can you do now? Like, how will you plan the next couple of months? Do you know it will be next year, or are you just hoping it will be next year?
No, I have no information personally, so you know, I don't have more information than you have. Then again, I always try to solve things, you know, instead of just waiting, being a bit proactive. And there are different solutions. We try to use the next window then in end of May, June, to probably play against one of the Olympic participants and so on. But it comes to resources, and sometimes we need to decide then, or we go back maybe and do something more with the domestic players in Ghana, maybe using training stays without playing officially and so on. We have a group of women, female leaders in Ghana who try to work a lot for the environment of the Black Queens in terms of finding also specific sponsorships, you know. We had a company now, they also, you know, release also their workers to watch our games and so on, that we have more spectators and so on. So we try on different level to get resources in. And in the end, we need to decide then with what we have, what is possible to do. But I always think to doing something is always better than to just wait and doing nothing.
And I think it's so important that you're talking about, you know, when we think often from the outside about these tournaments, if they get postponed or delayed, you know, we're often thinking, okay, how will it fit with the next World Cup and clashing with different tournaments and things like that? But it's like you say, it's even just the simple things like, do you know, now we have to do friendlies instead of qualifiers, and how can we afford that? And, you know, like I was saying, I spent time in Cote d'Ivoire, and I think they're on the flip side, one of the real sad stories of women's football on the continent, where they can, you know, put out this tournament for, you know, that cost them well over $1 billion for the men's AFCON, and their women's team had to pull out because of the Olympic qualifiers, because they didn't have the money. And, you know, they haven't paid for a friendly, I think, in over a decade. You know, the only friendlies they've done has been teams like Morocco or Algeria, like kind of funding it for the Ivorians themselves. And again, it must be so frustrating for you as a coach when you have other federations, you know, maybe not South Africa and Nigeria, but Morocco and Zambia, and specifically Morocco, who, you know, they will pay for their teams to have those friendlies. They will organize those friendlies against European opposition, North American opposition, even if they don't have the kind of structure of the WAFCON to give them that. You know, I wanted to ask you, Nora, because, you know, we've talked a lot about the amazing things you've done, the good stuff about the Black Queens, but you know, that you came up against your kind of biggest challenge, I would say, in the Olympic qualifiers, when you came up against Zambia, you know, Zambia, who kind of blew us away first at the Olympics with Barbara Banda's brilliance, and then without her at the women's AFCON, you know, coming third, beating Nigeria in the semifinal or in the third place playoff. And, you know, you as you mentioned, you know, you narrowly lost 1-0 in the first leg, probably should have got drawn there. In the second leg, you were like seconds away from taking them to, I think, extra time. There's not away goals in the Olympics, I think. But then Barbara Banda scores that 96th minute winner. You know, what are the lessons that you kind of take away from that game? Because you've played decent teams up to that point. You know, Senegal, they drew Zambia at the WAFCON. They only lost 1-0 to Morocco. They're a good team. And you beat them twice. But Zambia were kind of your first real test with genuine superstars like Barbara Banda. You know, how obviously you're disappointed with the result, but how helpful was that experience in terms of learning, you know, potentially ahead of a WAFCON where you will have to play Nigeria, Zambia, South Africa, these kind of heavyweight teams?
Yeah, a lot of questions in one. First of all, of course, it's painful when you drop out of a qualification. My experience is normally I am imagining most the biggest losses. It's not even the biggest six. I played European Championship and semi-final and so on, but normally the moments of loss stay the most. But you learn also the most out of it, out of those games. You normally reach when you do a good reflection on it and take the right conclusions out, then you end up on a next level. It sounds a bit weird, but sometimes you need to lose that you can achieve the next level. And when we look very clear on the performance side of the games, we went a bit into with too much respect into the first leg at home. And in the mid-time, we switched a bit the system and could very quick learn and grow with the game. We had a statistical high dominance in second half in possession. That was also for us good to see that our the Ghanaian DNA is to have possession, to play possession football. And we can play possession against, you know, a World Cup team. So, and normally in the XG we should score two goals, you know, on the rate, and Zambia was on the XG value one. So normally, and statistic wise, this game needs to end 2-1 for us. But then it's football. You hit the post, you know, and lose the first game, and then again, what do you learn for the second game? It was fantastic atmosphere in Dola, 25,000 crazy footballers. But again, we have 5 under 20 players from the last under 20 on the pitch. So they are young players. They need also to learn and grow with this atmosphere. I think we had the management was very good. But we went in behind, equalized 1-1. Then we lead at 2-2 the game, 2-1. Then it was 2-2 and 3-2. So I think performance-wise, we showed that we can grow with the pressure and good players with a high potential, they can learn in those pressure games and go with the level. It's very interesting. And so you see also which of your squad are growing in this pressure. And in the end, 96 minutes, yeah, Banda, she played flat through the wall. Maybe we should have laid the crocodile behind. So you always learn and learn. It gives you new challenges, and then you need to adapt with new answers. But I am proud that we had so many answers short-term ready and could already deliver on the pitch. In possession, we dominated them. I think it was especially the 20 minutes, second half, it was beautiful football also to watch, you know, it was dominance, it was possession. And when you can play this, then it's you know, okay, we can easily develop on the next level based on this performance. So in the end, the result was still not there. But I learned in Switzerland in my career as player that we also sometimes you need to scratch the bar, you know, in these qualifications. And when you do it 2-3 times, once there is the day where you already know before the game, now we step over it. And then it's this, you have this confidence. It's very hard to explain when you never played or, and I'm pretty sure In the next high level game, there will be then the time where we can say now we step over it and qualify. You know, but we need to have more of those high level games. This is in the end really developing the best player to a next level.
Coach, it has been a pleasure talking to you and kind of hearing about your brilliant journey, not only your own journey, but the journey of the Black Queens. And, you know, it's as I said at the beginning, it's a good thing for African football to see Ghana back where they belong at the top table. And we appreciate so much of your time and joining us today. And if you're listening or watching and you're interested in women's football, you're interested in football on the continent, do give us a follow on the Whistle podcast. You can find us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, OTW_podcast, and on YouTube and wherever you get your audio podcasts on the Whistle podcast for all the best interviews like the one today. And we get some of the coolest names and most interesting names like Coach Nora. Thank you so much once again for joining us.
It was a pleasure. And I travel so much, you know, so I have a lot of time to listen to podcasts. Actually, I do a lot because I can also learn a lot through other opinions. So it will be a pleasure to join your podcast in future. Thank you.
Amazing.
Very much.
Thank you so much.